You're listening to WXOJ LP 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio, streaming on the net at valleyfreeradio.org. That's valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Alan Vogel, your host and reader, here every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on the show Lit 103.3, Fiction for the Ears. Have an interesting show today. I'm going to read some excerpts from the debut novel by Shirley Riva Vernick entitled The Blood Lie. The Blood Lie is a YA novel, and I will talk about it, read some excerpts, and afterward, I will read some excerpts from the October 27th New York Review of Books, which included the first part of an unpublished, previously unpublished essay by the late Saul Bellow. And that's called The Jewish Writer in America. If we have any time after that, perhaps I'll talk about some of the books that I would be recommending right about now. And I'll tell you right coming out of the gate, The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides is excellent on so many levels, and I hope I have a chance to talk about it. If you've read any negative reviews, forget about them. Read the book. It's great on many levels, including it is a return to narrative. It's a story. A second book I would highly recommend is The Art of Fielding by Chad Harback. Do not read them back to back. I feel there are certain similarities, and The Art of Fielding is a particularly long book. Utterly readable, really just a wonderful book. The story, of course, behind this is that Chad Harback had a lot of trouble getting published, and this is his first novel, and he got $800,000 for it. So now somebody's writing a book about how this book got published. But if we clear away all the marketing issues, it's a really good book as well. As I said, don't read them back to back. The very opposite of when I said, do read back-to-back Dana Spiota's Stone Arabia and Amy Waldman's The Submission. While very different in tone, those two deal in many ways with the same issue of art. What is art? The relationship of the artist to the art. And yet, they're so different that I really would recommend them back-to-back. But that's for later, if we have time. Let's get started with what we have planned for now. First, a few words about the show. Every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, Lit 103.3 Fiction for the Ears presents you with short readings, fiction, nonfiction, slice of life memoir, whatever works. I present work by local writers and from writers all over the country and as far away as England. I'll also talk about novels, fiction, writing, publishing, and the odd political rant simply because, as that great man once said, I am who I am. All of these shows, all of the shows in the five seasons in podcast form are archived at lit1033.com. That's lit1033.com. And you'll find them there in written and podcast form. If you would like to submit work to the show, please send it to this email address, lit1033@comcast.net. That's lit1033@comcast.net. Please include your work within the body of the email. Give me a word count, because different shows require different length stories, and biographical information, so I'll have something to say about you should your work be selected. And now let me tell you a little bit about Shirley Riva Vernick. Shirley grew up in Massena, New York, which is where The Blood Libel, the title of the book and the subject within the book, took place. Massena, by the way, is on the St. Lawrence River, not far from Ontario, so it is way upstate New York. Her father's family was directly victimized by the blood libel. Today, she lives with her husband, two daughters, and two frisky dogs in western Massachusetts, I believe Amherst. And in addition to running a popular storytelling website, storybee.org, Shirley's written for Cosmopolitan, Good Housekeeping, The Ladies' Home Journal, national newspapers, and the publications of Harvard, Johns Hopkins, and Boston University. The Blood Lie is her debut novel. First, let me tell you what the blood libel is for those of you who don't know. There are various versions of the blood libel, and most of them go back to the Middle Ages, but essentially it's that Jews kill Christian children to use their blood in the baking of matzah. One famous book that talked about this, and in fact it was, in my case, not the book, but the movie, The Fixer, that made me aware of the blood libel. The book won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the National Book Award in 1967, and the movie starred Alan Bates, and he got an Oscar nomination. But that one is about a fixer or a handyman who's living in Kiev without official papers, and he's arrested on suspicion of murder when a Christian boy is killed during Passover, and he's jailed without being officially charged, and he's treated poorly and interrogated, and he claims to be apolitical, but aside from the internal aspect of the movie and the man's own spiritual growth, the book ends with this man finally being charged and brought to trial. He famously concludes that there is no such thing as an apolitical man, especially a Jew. Well, it turns out, as I said earlier, that when Shirley was, I think, home from college once, and she was perhaps doing a sociology project or something along those lines, she was talking about it at the dinner table, and her father said that when he was a child, when he was growing up in the same town in Manassas, New York, a child went missing, and there was the claim of the blood libel that the town Jews, or someone within the town, some Jewish person within the town, was responsible. Her parents, I read, owned a popular clothing store, and the state police came in and searched the store, looking for evidence to see if it was her father or perhaps his parents who were involved with this missing child. It's a very frightening myth that continues to live with so many others. And what Shirley decided to do, being so moved by the fact that this craziness literally touched her life, the town she grew up in, has decided for her debut novel to write a young adult book based on it. And it's called The Blood Lie. I'll give you a little background. It takes place in 1928. Jack Poole is 16 years old, and he's about to be accused of murder. Jack is a talented cellist with a promising future. He daydreams about two things: becoming a professional musician and kissing Emmeline Durham, a girl he knows he can never be with. Life in the isolated village of Messina, New York, affords Jack plenty of time for his fantasies, but when little Daisy, Emmeline's sister, disappears in Paradise Woods, a seething lie turns his world into a living nightmare. And as I said, inspired by true events, The Blood Lie sheds new light on the dark but little-known episode in American history. When I was talking about The Fixer, I was talking about European history. And I don't even believe it was the 20th century. But here we're talking about American history, the day a town's veiled prejudices erupt into a raging blood libel. The book, by the way, was released on September 1st. I'd like to read you some excerpts from the book. Here are two short excerpts about the forbidden love between Jack and Emmeline. Emmeline inhabited a different world from Jack's, the world of Christians. Normally, her orbit would never have intersected his. The only reason Jack and Emmeline were friends, the only reason their younger sisters were playmates, was the miracle of their mother's unlikely alliance. And a second excerpt. In the sunlight, Emmeline's eyes shone gold, and her ash blonde hair reflected hints of red. Jack wondered what her hair smelled like today and decided on nutmeg or aniseed, something fresh and lively and a little exotic. She looked so beautiful to him that even her little flaws, the crowding of her teeth, the asymmetry of her eyebrows, made him feel crazy. And having once been an adolescent boy, I can say that Shirley has pretty much hit the nail on the head there. And now an excerpt on the setting of the book. Jack felt restless a lot lately, stuck in this remote little whistle stop that didn't even have a movie theater or a music store. Scarcely 5 miles from Ontario, Canada, Massena was locked between the St. Lawrence River on one side and the Adirondack Mountains on the other. A flat, bland expanse of nothingness. Most Massena men toiled as dairy farmers or laborers at the aluminum works, jobs they held all their lives and then passed on to their sons. People stayed on here, and so did their children, until no one seemed to notice the drudgery anymore. No one except Jack. Every day he felt this place trying to squeeze the music right out of him. And now this on spreading the rumor. So, what's all the secrecy? Trooper Victor Brown asked once he and Gus Poulos got into the police car in front of the Durham's house. I'll tell you flat out, Gus said. It's time you knew. This girl who disappeared, it's the Jews. His lips curled as if the very word tasted bitter. What do you mean, the Jews? They have strange customs for their holidays, terrible customs. They use blood, drink it, and bake it in their special foods. Blood of a Christian child, not one of their own. One of their big holidays is in a couple of days, see? They call it Yom Kippur or something. That's why they took Daisy. I just hope they didn't murder her yet, that they're holding her, holding on to her until their big day. If you move fast enough, you might save her. Victor's eyes narrowed and he started twiddling his mustache. What makes you so sure about this? One of them Jews came into the diner a few minutes ago and couldn't keep his mouth shut, kept dropping hints, like he felt guilty and needed to talk. I put two and two together, that's all. Victor gripped the steering wheel. Stop futzing with them woods for a kid who isn't even there, Gus persisted. Listen to me. I'm telling you the truth. I know what goes on in this town. I hear everything every day at the diner. It's those Jews that... This Jew you talked to, this... What'd you say his name was? Poole. Jack Poole. Poole's dry goods kid, Gus said. Any idea where they got her? Couldn't get that much out of them, but listen, their stores are already closed for the holiday, locked up, black as night. Wouldn't you say that was convenient if you have a child or her body to hide? And now this on the police searching Jack's family store. Jack hit the light switch, and Trooper Brown started walking the perimeter of the pool store. He probed the racks of trousers and felt behind the cabinets. He stood on tiptoes to check the wall shelves. Then he poked his head into the fitting room and the tiny bathroom in the back. Jack stepped away from the door so the crowd outside couldn't see him. My God, he thought, watching the trooper open cupboards and drawers. He actually expects to find little body parts scattered around. He thinks he's going to uncover fingers and kneecaps, teeth and organs if he just looks hard enough. And this on Jack's anger at the situation. Is this what being a Jew gets me? Is this my reward for studying Torah and keeping kosher and missing every single baseball game? Jack wasn't just mad at the Jew haters anymore. He was mad at God. How could you let this happen? And this on historical context from the author's note at the end of the book. 5 years after the blood lie in Messina, Hitler took power in Germany and began using the blood lie to justify the oppression and ultimate slaughter of the Jews. In 1937, Der Stürmer, a popular Nazi newspaper, even published a special ritual murder edition. This is an excerpt. The carrying out, and remember, this is not fiction now. This is from a 1937 Der Stürmer newspaper article published by the Nazi Party, which was dominant and had won the elections of 32. The carrying out of ritual murders is a law to the devout Jew. The blood of the victims is tapped by force. On Passover, it is used in wine and matzahs. The family head empties a few drops of fresh or powdered blood into the glass, wets the fingers, and blesses with it everything on the table. Then he exclaims, "May all Gentiles perish as the child whose blood is contained in the bread and wine." The Jew believes he absolves himself thus of his sins. Although dates like 1928 and 1937 may seem like a lifetime ago, ritual murder accusations are anything but dead in the 21st century. In 2002, for instance, a student demonstration at San Francisco State University featured posters of a soup can whose label showed dripping blood, a dead baby with its stomach sliced open, and the words, "Made in Israel, Palestinian children meat, slaughtered according to Jewish rites under American license." The same year, a Saudi newspaper ran an article describing how Jewish vampires extract the blood of teenagers to use in their Purim holiday pastries. Clearly, the blood lie is alive and well in our world. So is hatred against other groups based on their race, religion, ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity. From cyberbullying to violent physical attacks, vandalism to murder, oppression is out there. In 2004 alone, there were more than 9,000 reported hate offenses in the United States, according to the FBI. That does not include all the incidents that go unreported, the name-calling, exclusion, intimidation, property destruction, and other offenses that people don't talk about. I personally am very proud that serious writers are writing young adult fiction. As a reader, from the time I could put two words together, I remember going through the young adult section, but there was really nothing of substance there, and so I would go up towards the adult books and little by little find books that I could understand most of the words in. Today, there are magnificent young adult books, and they're not all just Harry Potter. Personally, I think every parent has responsibility to direct their children toward serious literature and serious issues. And it would seem to me that Shirley Burnick's book, The Blood Lie, would be a great book for your child's collection. There is an age for this. I know some people say, "I don't want my kid to know this. I don't want to perpetuate these things." But I think that only by facing them, and by facing them in this fictional form, with Shirley's addendum that this goes on, is a powerful way to introduce children at the right age to the fact that there are written and verbally transmitted myths and lies about Jews, blacks, every minority. But I can't tell you how blown away I was when I watched a movie. It was called, I believe, K Like Me, as in Kike Like Me. It's a great documentary. The protagonist in it, the person who takes you around, won't say whether he's Jewish or not. It seems that he clearly is, but that's part of it as well. Will you look at him differently? Why do you want to know? But he goes up into Harlem in Upper Manhattan and into the South Bronx and talks to groups of black folk on the corner. And they are clear in their utter belief that it was Jews who were behind 9/11. And they are clear, they cite the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a propaganda text that goes back forever and has become very popular again, as proof of the Jewish character. So I want to thank Shirley for writing this book and making it available. And again, I want to recommend it, The Blood Lie by Shirley Reba Burnick, And it is published, I'm sure you can get it anywhere in town or online, no question about that, by Cinco Puntos Press. Okay. Moving on to Saul Bellow. It's very interesting, and the beginning of this article, which I'll read, really gave me a chuckle, because there clearly was a time, and I'm sure there are many students and professors are still involved with semiotics and postmodern deconstruction, the idea that the text is what speaks in a piece of writing, and that the writer in many ways is irrelevant to the text, and that everything must be seen relative to the culture of the writing. I won't go on, but one thing that I thought was wonderful, Jeffrey Eugenides, who went to Brown, which was ground zero for the birth of that movement, had a wonderful line in his book, The Marriage Plot, where he talks about the entitled generation which, through semiotics, has finally reached its goal of rendering the writer irrelevant and making the entire experience about them, the reader. Okay, I'm biased. I'm going to say that coming right out of the gate. I think that there is something to be said for postmodern deconstruction, but I also have to chuckle when people explain a writer's writer to the writer and then tell him that he really doesn't know what it is that he's writing. We're on Facebook. If you think I'm being too simplistic, which I am, or you have a problem with what I'm saying, go to Lit 103.3, Fiction for the Ears, on Facebook. Let me know. Start a dialogue. It's an interesting one. There was also the anecdote about how Derrida, the postmodern, the god, one of the gods of postmodernism, was asked a question. And honestly, I don't remember now if this was fiction or true. I'm somewhat embarrassed, but I'll just keep talking because this is Valley Free Radio. Was asked a question using the verbiage of the postmodernist. And because the postmodernist ultimately believes that you can't really find meaning in anything, that there really is no ultimate meaning, the question, as is much of Derrida's writing, was so convoluted that it's really impossible to understand. And he posed this to Derrida. And after a long pause, Derrida looks at him and says, "I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're talking about." So with that as my short introduction, I want to read from the beginning, but I'm not going to read the entire article, but I do want to read certainly the beginning of Saul Bellow's unpublished essay on the Jewish writer in America, because I believe that he has to deal with this issue in writing the essay about himself. And by the way, Bellow won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1976, was the author of 17 books of fiction, died in 2005, and as I said, this talk has never been published. A few preliminary words on the title of this talk, and as I said, the title of this talk is A Jewish Writer in America. It deals with aspects of my personal history, and with the substantiality of the person behind this history. The idea of a substantial person has been subjected by modernist, postmodernist, and post-postmodernist thinkers to tests which make one think of the rude use of effigies by engineers who simulate car collisions and plane crashes. Dummies are dismembered before our eyes or devoured by floods of ignited aviation fuel. The identity problem has vexed and plagued the modern intellect. So what business have I, in view of the new look for individuals, in a word for each and every one of us, sponsored by highly influential existentialist, deconstructionist, and nihilist designers, to speak of my personality and my personal history. And the truth is that no such right can be formally defended by a writer, a novelist, who in any case would have neither the time nor the metaphysical competency to do the job. All I have to say is that the learned philosophers and critics have raised some questions which perhaps do not have to be raised. Sinister questions, which I associate with an even more sinister challenge, the challenge, namely, to one's right to exist in any form. The philosopher Maurice Arcon was once asked by a student, "Professor, how do I know that I exist?" "So," Cohn replied, "and who is asking?" Thanks to Professor Cohn, I feel that I stand on firmer ground and can do what I have done all my life, i.e., to fall back instinctively on my first consciousness, which has always seemed to me to be the most real and easily accessible. For people who have no access to any such core consciousness, no mysteries exist. Linguistic analysts aim to clear away all mysteries, alleged mysteries, they would say. Facts, however, must be respected, and the fact is that for reasons I can't explain, my own first consciousness has had a long, unbroken history. I wouldn't know how to defend my faithful attachment to it. All I can say is that it is a fact, and I wonder why anyone should feel it necessary to put its reality in doubt. But our meddling mental world puts all such realities in doubt. This world of truly modern, educated, advanced consciousness suspects the core consciousness that I take to be a fact of being inauthentic and probably delusive. I will ask you for the present to believe that I am right, and that what I call the meddling mental world is wrong. Well, I'm going to stop there for a moment and just say kudos to Saul Bellow, because the bottom line is the approach he's taken, I think, is the only approach you can take to this onslaught of, I'll call it, postmodernism. And he continues, "So in my first consciousness, I was, among other things, a Jew, the child of Jewish immigrants. At home, our parents spoke Russian to each other. We children spoke Yiddish with them, and we spoke English with one another. At the age of 4, we began to read the Old Testament in Hebrew. We observed Jewish customs, some of them superstitions, and we recited prayers and blessings all day long. Because I had to memorize most of Genesis, my first consciousness was that of a cosmos, and in that cosmos, I was a Jew. I suppose it would be proper to apply the word archaic to such a representation of the world as I had. Archaic, prehistoric. This was my given, and it would be idle to quarrel with it, to try to revise or efface it. A millennial belief in a holy God may have the effect of deepening the soul, but it is also obviously archaic. And modern influences would presently bring me up to date and reveal how antiquated my origins were. To turn away from those origins, however, has always seemed to me an utter impossibility. It would be a treason to my first consciousness to un-Jew myself. One may be tempted to go behind the given and invent something better, to attempt to re-enter life at a more advantageous point. In America, this is common. We've all seen it done, and done in many instances with great ingenuity. But the thought of such an attempt never entered my mind. Thus, I may have been archaic, but I escaped the horrors of an identity crisis." I'm going to move now to a point further along in the essay. "Having begun this talk without an adequate perspective, I now begin to see an intent in it. The condition I am looking into is that of a young American who in the late 30s finds that he is something like a writer and begins to think what to do about it, how to position himself, and how to combine being a Jew with being an American and a writer. Not everyone thinks well of such a project. The young man is challenged from all sides. Representatives of the Protestant majority want to see his credentials. Less overtly hostile, because they are more snobbish, the English want to know who he is or what he thinks he is. Later, his French publishers will invariably turn his books over to Jewish translators. The Jews, too, try to place him. Is he too Jewish? Is he Jewish enough? Is he good or bad for the Jews? Jews in business or politics ask, must we forever be reading this about this damn Jews, his damn Jews? Jewish critics examine him with a certain sharpness, and they have their own axes to grind. As the sons of Jewish immigrants, descendants of the people whose cackling and shrieking set Henry James on edge when he visited the East Side, they accuse themselves secretly of presumption when they write of Emerson, Walt Whitman, or Matthew Arnold. My own view is that since Henry James and Henry Adams did not hesitate to express their dislike of Jews, there's no reason why Jews, while full of respect for these masters, should not be free to write as they please about them. I'm going to move on, but first I want to make the point that, isn't it interesting, probably 10 years younger or a little more is Philip Roth, who took his writing and his early writing, Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint, books that told the world things that always lived behind the closed doors of Jewish households, that Roth was subject to the same criticisms, and certainly by the Jewish community, who called him self-hating. And of course, there's always that equation, is this bad for the Jews? Is this good for the Jews? How does this affect the Jews? People may not understand why this constant balancing act, why the need to understand this equation. But if you look at things like the blood libel and what happened in Germany and why most Jews left Europe, and why Israel is so important to them, certainly that generation, as well as the current generation, but I think issues have changed, but still, that is why Israel is so important to them, is because ultimately they have lived at the sufferance of the country to which they are often regarded as visitors, no matter how long they've lived there. And so to be clear, when I say Israel being important to them, I'm including all Jewish people in that. While one may disagree with the politics of how things are being handled, the bottom line is, even today, in the country that they were given after the slaughter, they are being told it is not their right to have that sovereign country, that people can shoot rockets at will, and yet only the blockade will draw outcries, not the rockets being shot into their country. Think about that if you lived in California, Southern California, or New Mexico, or Texas, and groups were firing rockets at random, thousands of rockets. And though not that many people were killed, there was a fairly significant degree of PTSD and fear. But people said, this is nothing. What you do is so terrible. In any event, I digress. So, again, you can find the show on Facebook, and you can feel free to comment, because I think a full and fair expression of ideas is what makes this country great, and more importantly, what makes this radio station great. I'll move on now to Bello. Gershom Scholem, whose books I admire, was less gentle with me. I am told that a statement that I was said to have made in 1976 when I won the Nobel Prize put him in a rage. I was quoted in the papers as saying that I was an American writer and a Jew. Perhaps I should have said that I was a Jew and an American writer. Because Sholem is one of the greatest scholars of the century, I'm sorry I offended him. But having made this bow in his direction, I allow myself to add that the question reminds me of the one small children used to be asked by the clumsy Sunday visitors in olden times. Whom do you love better, your mama or your papa? I recognized that I answered the reporter unthinkingly, writer first, Jew second. And I'll go on. In the U.S., a land of foreigners who may or may not be in the process of forming a national type, who can predict how it will all turn out, a term like medic is inapplicable. To renew the purity of the tribe was a French project, and a man whose French is acceptable to the French is, at least in the act of speaking, a claimant to aristocratic status. But Gentile New York and Brahmin Boston never dominated American speech, and the aristocratic pretensions of Easterners were good for a laugh in the rest of the country. Yet when our own medics, the Jewish, Italian, and Armenian descendants of immigrants, began after World War I to write novels, they caused great discomfort and, in some quarters, alarm and rage. Irving Howe has noted in a reminiscence of the Partisan Review days that, quote, portions of the native intellectual elite found the modest fame of the New York writers insufferable. Soon they were mumbling that American purities of speech and spirit were being contaminated by the streets of New York. Anti-Semitism had become publicly disreputable in the years after the Holocaust, a thin coating of shame having settled on civilized consciousness. But this hardly meant that some native writers would lack a vocabulary for private use about those New York usurpers, those Bronx and Brooklyn wise guys who proposed to reshape American literary life. When Truman Capote later attacked the Jewish writers on television, he had the dissolute courage to say what more careful gentlemen had quietly said among themselves. Capote said that a Jewish mafia was taking over American literature and New York publishing as well. And that was in 1979. And I believe we've been reading about the Jewish takeover of the entertainment industry. I always laugh about the banks. For those of you who don't understand the joke, banks historically have not hired Jews to high positions. So the idea of the Jews owning the banks is laughable. Of course, those comments were during the Glass-Steagall days when you had banks separate from commercial banking. Obviously, Jews have been involved in the brokerage houses and that sort of thing. And moving on, for a Jew, the proper attitude to adopt was the Nietzschean, to despise being despised. However disagreeable the phenomenon may seem at moments of sensitivity, it is seldom more than trivial. The dislike of Jews was a ready way for WASP literati to identify themselves with the great tradition. Besides, it is something like a hereditary option for non-Jews to exercise at a certain moment when they discover that they have a born right to decide whether they are for the Jews or against them. Jews have no such right. At the beginning of the century, it offered an opportunity to stand with distinguished intellectual groups of the right. How nice if you came from Idaho or Missouri to identify yourself with Morass or the anti-Dreyfusards. And then this. But I think I may be spending too much time on the culture bosses who dominated writers and ruled over English departments and literary journalism. A genteel direct dictatorship inspired by T.S. Eliot, with a roughneck faction headed by Ezra Pound, and describing itself as traditionalist was in fact profoundly racist. But such things are ultimately without importance, merely distracting. What is imposed upon us by birth and environment is what we are called upon to overcome. The business of the Jewish writer, as Carl Shapiro rightly says in his indispensable book, In Defense of Ignorance, is not to complain about society, but to go beyond complaint. These merely social matters, unpleasant, uncomfortable, are reduced to triviality by the crushing weight of the Jewish experience of our own time. So those are some thoughts from the late Saul Bellow on being a Jewish writer. Okay, it is 1:40 and 35 seconds right here at WXOJ LP 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Alan Vogel, your host and reader. Every Tuesday at 1 o'clock at Lit 103.3, Fiction for the Ears. Again, all shows are archived at the website lit1033.com. That's lit1033.com. And if you'd like to submit work, please send it to lit103.3@comcast.net. lit103.3@comcast.net. Include your name, some biographical information, the work, which can be fiction or nonfiction, creative nonfiction, slice of life memoir. Please include that not as an attachment, but in the body of the email and the word count. You know, I was going to talk about some books, but I feel like I've done enough talking for one afternoon. So we have a few minutes left. And I think we should listen to some classic Lit 103.3 Fiction for the Ears music. And by that, I mean music that tells a story where we listen to the lyrics and let the music add the emotional power. Let's start with one we haven't heard in a while, but it's a heck of a story by David Bromberg, Mr. Bojangles.
You know, I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. And worn out shoes, silver hair, a ragged shirt and baggy pants. You do the old soft shoe. He jumped so high, you know he jumped so high. And then he'd lightly touch down. Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles. Come on down. I met him in a cell down in New Orleans. All right. I was down and out. He looked to me to be the eyes of age. As he spoke right out, he talked of life. Yes, he talked of life. He laughed and slapped his leg a step. He said the name Bojangles, and then he danced a lick across the cell. Hey, he grabbed his pants for a better stance. So he jumped up high, high. He clicked his heels. He let go a laugh. You know he let go a laugh. Shook back his clothes all around. Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangle. Mr. Bojangle, come on, dance. This is really a true story, you know. A lot of people have heard the song, and well, at least Jerry Jeff tells me it's a true story. I played guitar with Jerry Jeff Walker for about 2 years, and we did this song every night for 2 years, and I never got tired of it. Jerry got a little tired of it. That night after the clubs had closed, we'd do horrible things to it. But it's a true story. This guy, Bojangles, was a street dancer in New Orleans, and what he'd do is he'd go from bar to bar, and he'd put money in the jukebox or get somebody else to do it, and then he'd either dance or pantomime the tune, right? And for that, people would buy him drinks and get him pretty drunk, and then he'd go on to the next bar and next one until it was closing time, and then he'd go and do it the next night. And after a few nights of this, he'd end up on the corner, and the cops would pick him up, and they'd take him to the drunk tank, which is where Jerry Jeff met him. Jerry Jeff wasn't there on a research project. I mean, the way I got that story, I may have that wrong, but the way I got that is that he propositioned the right woman at the right time in the wrong place. And her husband, the bartender, called the cops, and they took Jerry to the parish jail. And this guy just talked for 3 days in the cell about, you know, what he'd done. Said he danced for those at minstrel shows and county fairs. Throughout the South, he spoke with tears of 15 years how his dog and him had traveled about. His dog up and died, you know, his dog up and died. After 20 years, he still grieves. Said I dance now at every chance in the honky tonks for drinks and tips, but most of the time I spend behind these county bars, 'cause I drinks a bit. He shook his head, and as he shook his head, someone asked, please. Mr. Bojangle. Mr. Bojangle.
The next story and song I want to play is really a heartbreaker, written likely in the 30s when a black man had to be careful what he said and how he said it. A song that is beautiful and touching in so many ways. Louis Armstrong playing the trumpet and singing, "What Did You Do to Be So Black and Blue?" We have time for one more, and this last one takes storytelling to the next stage. It's Ben Folds live singing Hiroshima, parentheses, BBB, Benny Hit His Head, in which he tells the story of when he fell on stage in Tokyo while performing.
Crowd is a busted ass off the front of the station. Is a rush of adrenaline, is a concrete rose to meet my face. Maybe it was a sheer embarrassment that kept me conscious and standing. As I crawled back up onto the stage and started pounding out the first song, there was blood on the keyboard. Oh my god.
There you have it. Another show wrapping it up. It's coming up on 158. I want to thank Shirley Riva Vernick for allowing us to read some excerpts from her book, The Blood Lie, a novel. And all of you for tuning in and supporting the show. Purposes of this show is to support writers and writing, and to provide a platform for thought. And I certainly think we've done that today. Again, you can find us on Facebook, Lit 103.3 Fiction for the Ears. My name is Alan Vogel, your host and reader of Lit 103.3 Fiction for the Ears, inviting you back next Monday at 1 o'clock. Until then, keep reading.